Behind the Scenes by Elizabeth Keckley. Chapter 7. Washington in 1862 to 1863. In the summer of 1862, freedmen began to flock into Washington from Maryland and Virginia. They came with a great hope in their hearts and with all their worldly goods on their backs. Fresh from the bonds of slavery, fresh from the benighted regions of the plantation, they came to the capital looking for liberty, and many of them not knowing it when they found it. Many good friends reached forth kind hands, but the North is not warm and impulsive. For one kind word spoken, two harsh ones were uttered. There was something repelling in the atmosphere, and the bright, joyous dreams of freedom to the slave faded, were sadly altered in the presence of that stern, practical mother, reality. Instead of flowery paths, days of perpetual sunshine, and bowers hanging with golden fruit, the road was rugged and full of thorns, the sunshine was eclipsed by shadows, and the mute appeals for help too often were answered by cold neglect. Poor dusky children of slavery, men and women of my own race, the transition from slavery to freedom was too sudden for you. The bright dreams were too rudely dispelled. You were not prepared for the new life that opened before you, and the great masses of the North learned to look upon your helplessness with indifference, learned to speak of you as an idle, dependent race. Reason should have prompted kinder thoughts. Charity is ever kind. One fair summer evening, I was walking the streets of Washington, accompanied by a friend, when a band of music was heard in the distance. We wondered what it could mean, and curiosity prompted us to find out its meaning. We quickened our steps and discovered that it came from the house of Mrs. Farnham. The yard was brilliantly lighted, ladies and gentlemen were moving about, and the band was playing some of its sweetest airs. We approached the sentinel on duty at the gate and asked what was going on. He told us that it was a festival given for the benefit of the sick and wounded soldiers in the city. This suggested an idea to me. If the white people can give festivals to raise funds for the relief of suffering soldiers, why should not the well-to-do colored people go to work to do something for the benefit of the suffering blacks? I could not rest. The thought was ever present with me, and the next Sunday I made a suggestion in the colored church that a society of colored people be formed to labor for the benefit of the unfortunate freedmen. The idea proved popular, and in 2 weeks, the Contraband Relief Association was organized with 40 working members. In September of 1862, Mrs. Lincoln left Washington for New York and requested me to follow her in a few days and join her at the Metropolitan Hotel. I was glad of the opportunity to do so, for I thought that in New York I would be able to do something in the interest of our society. Armed with credentials, I took the train for New York and went to the Metropolitan, where Mrs. Lincoln had secured accommodations for me. The next morning I told Mrs. Lincoln of my project, and she immediately headed my list with a subscription of $200. I circulated among the colored people and got them thoroughly interested in the subject. When I was called to Boston by Mrs. Lincoln, who wished to visit her son Robert, attending college in that city, I met Mr. Wendell Phillips and other Boston philanthropists who gave me all the assistance in their power. We held a mass meeting at the Colored Baptist Church. Reverend Mr. Grimes in Boston raised a sum of money and organized there a branch society. The society was organized by Mrs. Grimes, wife of the pastor, assisted by Mrs. Martin, wife of Reverend Stella Martin. This branch of the main society during the war was able to send us over 80 large boxes of goods contributed exclusively by the colored people of Boston. Returning to New York, we held a successful meeting at the Shiloh Church, Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, pastor. The Metropolitan Hotel, at that time as now, employed colored help. I suggested the object of my mission to Robert Thompson, steward of the hotel, who immediately raised quite a sum of money among the dining room waiters. Mr. Frederick Douglass contributed $200, besides lecturing for us. Other prominent colored men sent in liberal contributions. From England, a large quantity of stores was received. Mrs. Lincoln made frequent contributions, as also did the president. In 1863, I was re-elected president of the association, which office I continue to hold. For 2 years after Willie's death, the White House was the scene of no fashionable display. The memory of the dead boy was duly respected. In some things, Mrs. Lincoln was an altered woman. Sometimes, when in her room, with no one present but myself, the mere mention of Willie's name would excite her emotion, and any trifling memento that recalled him would move her to tears. She could not bear to look upon his picture, and after his death she never crossed the threshold of the guest room in which he died, or the green room in which he was embalmed. There was something supernatural in her dread of these things, and something that she could not explain. Tad's nature was the opposite of Willie's, and he was always regarded as his father's favorite child. His black eyes fairly sparkled with mischief. The war progressed. Fair fields had been stained with blood. Thousands of brave men had fallen, and thousands of eyes were weeping for the fallen at home. There were desolate hearthstones in the South as well as in the North, and as the people of my race watched the sanguinary struggle, the ebb and flow of the tide of battle, they lifted their faces Zionward, as if they hoped to catch a glimpse of the promised land beyond the sulphurous clouds of smoke which shifted now and then, but to reveal ghastly rows of new-made graves. Sometimes the very life of the nation seemed to tremble with the fierce shock of arms. In 1863, the Confederates were flushed with victory, and sometimes it looked as if the proud flag of the Union, the glorious old stars and stripes, must yield half its nationality to the tri-barred flag that floated grandly over long columns of gray. These were sad, anxious days to Mr. Lincoln, and those who saw the man in privacy only could tell how much he suffered. One day he came into the room where I was fitting a dress on Mrs. Lincoln. His step was slow and heavy, and his face sad. Like a tired child, he threw himself upon a sofa and shaded his eyes with his hands. He was a complete picture of dejection. Mrs. Lincoln, observing his troubled look, asked, "Where have you been, Father?" "To the War Department," was the brief, almost sullen answer. "Any news?" "Yes, plenty of news, but no good news. It is dark, dark everywhere." He reached forth one of his long arms and took a small Bible from a stand near the head of the sofa, opened the pages of the holy book, and soon was absorbed in reading them. A quarter of an hour passed, and on glancing at the sofa, the face of the president seemed more cheerful. The dejected look was gone, and the countenance was lighted up with new resolution and hope. The change was so marked that I could not but wonder at it, and wonder led to the desire to know what book of the Bible afforded so much comfort to the reader. Making the search for a missing article an excuse, I walked gently around the sofa, and looking into the open book, I discovered that Mr. Lincoln was reading that divine comforter, Job. He read with Christian eagerness, and the courage and hope that he derived from the inspired pages made him a new man. I almost imagined that I could hear the Lord speaking to him from out the whirlwind of battle. "Gird up thy loins now like a man. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. What a sublime picture was this! A ruler of a mighty nation going to the pages of the Bible with simple Christian earnestness for comfort and courage, and finding both in the darkest hours of a nation's calamity. Ponder it, O ye scoffers at God's holy word, and then hang your heads for very shame. Frequent letters were received warning Mr. Lincoln of assassination, but he never gave a second thought to the mysterious warnings. The letters, however, sorely troubled his wife. She seemed to read impending danger in every rustling leaf, in every whisper of the wind. "Where are you going now, father?" she would say to him as she observed him putting on his overshoes and shawl. "I am going over to the War Department, mother, to try and learn some news." "But, father, you should not go out alone. You know you are surrounded with danger." "All imagination. What does anyone want to harm me for? Don't worry about me, mother, as if I were a little child, for no one is going to molest me." And with a confident, unsuspecting air, he would close the door behind him, descend the stairs, and pass out to his lonely walk. For weeks, when trouble was anticipated, friends of the president would sleep in the White House to guard him from danger. Robert would come home every few months, bringing new joy to the family circle. He was very anxious to quit school and enter the army, but the move was sternly opposed by his mother. "We have lost one son, and his loss is as much as I can bear without being called upon to make another sacrifice," she would say when the subject was under discussion. "But many a poor mother has given up all her sons," mildly suggested Mr. Lincoln, "and our son is not more dear to us than the sons of other people are to their mothers." "That may be, but I cannot bear to have Robert exposed to danger. His services are not required in the field, and the sacrifice would be a needless one." "The services of every man who loves his country are required in this war. You should take a liberal instead of a selfish view of the question, mother." Argument at last prevailed, and permission was granted Robert to enter the army. With the rank of captain and ADC, he went to the field and remained in the army till the close of the war. I well recollect a little incident that gave me a clearer insight into Robert's character. He was at home at the time the Tom Thumb combination was at Washington. The marriage of little Hopo, my thumb, Charles Stratton, to Miss Warren created no little excitement in the world, and the people of Washington participated in the general curiosity. Some of Mrs. Lincoln's friends made her believe that it was the duty of Mrs. Lincoln to show some attention to the remarkable dwarfs. Tom Thumb had been caressed by royalty in the old world, and why should not the wife of the president of his native country smile upon him also? Verily, duty is one of the greatest bugbears in life. A hasty reception was arranged, and cards of invitation issued. I had dressed Mrs. Lincoln, and she was ready to go below and receive her guests, when Robert entered his mother's room. "You are at leisure this afternoon, are you not, Robert?" "Yes, mother." "Of course, then. You will dress and come downstairs." "No, mother, I do not propose to assist in entertaining Tom Thumb. My notions of duty, perhaps, are somewhat different from yours." Robert had a lofty soul, and he could not stoop to all of the follies and absurdities of the ephemeral current of fashionable life. Mrs. Lincoln's love for her husband sometimes prompted her to act very strangely. She was extremely jealous of him, and if a lady desired to court her displeasure, she could select no surer way to do it than to pay marked attention to the president. These little jealous freaks often were a source of perplexity to Mr. Lincoln. If it was a reception for which they were dressing, he would come into her room to conduct her downstairs, and while pulling on his gloves, ask, with a merry twinkle in his eyes, "Well, mother, who must I talk with tonight? Shall it be Mrs. D?" "That deceitful woman? No, you shall not listen to her flattery." Well, then, what do you say to Miss C? She is too young and handsome to practice deceit. Young and handsome, you call her? You should not judge beauty for me. No, she is in league with Mrs. D, and you shall not talk with her. Well, Mother, I must talk with someone. Is there anyone that you do not object to? Trying to button his glove with a mock expression of gravity. I don't know as it is necessary that you should talk to anybody in particular. You know well enough, Mr. Lincoln, that I do not approve of your flirtations with silly women, just as if you were a beardless boy fresh from school. But, Mother, I insist that I must talk with somebody. I can't stand around like a simpleton and say nothing. If you will not tell me who I may talk with, please tell me who I may not talk with. There is Mrs. D and Miss C in particular. I detest them both. Mrs. B also will come around you, but you need not listen to her flattery. These are the ones in particular. Very well, Mother. Now that we have settled the question to your satisfaction, we will go downstairs. He proffered his arm and led the way. End of chapter. Read by Lorraine Montgomery for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.